In his new book, American Character, journalist Colin Woodard examines the history of and solutions to the key American question, how best to reconcile individual liberty with the maintenance of a free society. The struggle between individual rights and the good of the community as a whole has been the basis of nearly every major disagreement in our history, from the debates of the Constitutional Convention and in the run-up to the Civil War, to fights surrounding the agendas of the Federalists, the Progressives, the New Dealers, the Civil Rights Movement, and the Tea Party. Colin Woodard is currently the state and national affairs writer at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. His new book is American Character, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what brought you to this particular subject of wanting to look at our individual liberty?
Well, this sort of builds off the previous book, American Nations, which was a book about what is really dividing us as a country, that we're divided not just on ideological grounds, but on geographic, and that the two are linked together. And it explores the actual regional geography of the country, showing that the real divides date back and are tied to the differences between the different colonies way back in the beginning of the colonial period on the eastern and southern rims of what's now the United States. And each of those groups of colonies, you know, the New England colonies and the Chesapeake colonies and the Scots-Irish led backcountry of Appalachia and spreading on out into the parts of the Ohio Valley and so on, each had their own ethnographic and religious and ideological characteristics from the very beginning, and their different intents and ideals about what kind of America they were building. And they didn't think they were all going to be in one America. You know, it didn't start out with anyone thinking they would be in a continent-spanning federation. They settled mutually exclusive zones of the continent out into the 1840s, sort of formatting the cultural DNA, if you will, of different tiers of the country with their institutions and their, you know, narrative stories and constitutions and practices that were there as a fait accompli when others came. So I say that as a preamble because that book described a lot about the divides in our history and understanding our identity and why we're paralyzed. So the follow-up book, the one that's coming out now, is about how we get around that. How do you solve that problem? And what is the key thing that we've been really struggling over? And that is competing definitions of freedom, with freedom as defined primarily in individualistic terms, that the goal is to maximize the freedom and sovereignty of the individual to be without encumbrances, and a counter goal of trying to maximize the common good, the building and sustaining a free community and the structures that allow individuals to be free. And those two things can have opposite policy ramifications. And it's been a struggle for our history, so the book is trying to explore that to provide some answers and also provide some answers about how do you actually, you know, successfully manage and maximize universal human freedom, which is rather a tricky challenge that we humans have only been doing for a couple of centuries.
As you note, and as you just said, it has always been a struggle. So there's never been a point where there was a golden era that we got it right.
Not precisely, although the goal was to look through our historical experience. And you have all these different regional cultures. We're balkanized, and each of the regional cultures has a different idea about where the balance point between those forces should lie. Now, if you run to one extreme or the other, you actually end up in tyranny. You know, if you go too far into the common good and collectivist realm where the individual stands down completely for the alleged common good, you can start having individuals committing thought crimes, and pretty soon you're down with Stalin's Soviet Union and Hitler's fatherland, where the individuals must conform completely to the ideology that's set forth by the keepers of the common good. And you go in the other direction where you continue reducing government and the taxes that support the sort of civic infrastructure and public infrastructure of a society, and you'll get to the point where a government starts no longer effectively keeping the competitive world of the America free and fair. So you have a situation where monopolies start forming that threaten the free economy, and a social situation where intergenerationally you roll it out a few generations, and many people don't have an opportunity really to succeed in pursuing their potential because a few families end up monopolizing and gathering together, you know, maximizing their freedom and reducing the freedom of others. You get an oligarchy like Guatemala or El Salvador or Honduras today, where, you know, a few families control absolutely everything. So I say that as a preamble because there you need to have a balance point between those forces to find that golden age sweet spot. And the closest we've gotten, you know, we've been on to one side or the other of the middle at different times and pulled back from it like a pendulum. But the time where it seemed like we had the forces in balance and had the political support for the ideas for the foundations for it, we're in that long period of the sort of Greater New Deal, starting in 1933 and really running all the way through Eisenhower's presidency and JFK and LBJ and even on through Nixon until 72, where you had the idea of government as a, you know, needing to be acting as the referee to keep the marketplace fair and to provide the context and possibilities so that, you know, most people will have a shot at entering the competition on fair grounds, which requires, you know, they had higher taxation to make major, societal investments, you know, be it land grant and sea grant universities and the interstate highway system and the Apollo program and so on and so forth. So that is the time, and it had bipartisan consensus, and that was the time where it seemed like we were sort of closest to being in equilibrium and balance, and where a broad swath of the American public and across many of these regions was in support of the general policy framework.
Talk about the geography of this issue and how the various cultures that we have in this country, the regional cultures, played a part.
Yes, well, each of the regional cultures has a very different idea about that balance point, about how, you know, whether individual freedom is most important or the good of the community. Two quick examples. For instance, the northern tier of the country is the area that is tied back to New England settlement, sort of the greater New England. And in the early Puritans in Massachusetts Bay, whose descendants through the 1840s largely were those who settled and led settlement in much of upstate New York and in the Western Reserve of Ohio, which had been claimed by Connecticut, and on into Michigan and many of the upper Great Lakes states. That whole zone was influenced by the Puritan idea that, you know, they had come to build a more perfect society on earth, right? It was supposed to be an example to the world, a more godly place, a light on the hill, a city on the hill. And they were going to do it through a collective effort through public institutions, and they believed that individuals were, you know, wicked, and if they weren't, you know, monitored and kept in check, they'd run amok and make a mess of things. So the individual had to always stand down for the good of the community and the thing that they were building. And that general idea that government is us and that you work through public institutions to try to engineer better outcomes for society comes more naturally to people in that Yankeedom zone than it does to a lot of other people. And it's a relatively communitarian kind of approach, and that freedom is about preventing individual tyrants from rising up in our ranks and oppressing us. You know, that's one view of how you maintain freedom. The big contrast is that Scots-Irish, you know, greater Appalachian area that I described, and which extends on all the way down into the Ozarks and the Texas Hill Country and tiers of the Midwest. And that's a culture where the people were coming from Ulster and from the lowlands of Scotland and from the English marches, from the war-torn borderlands of Britain, places where there had been continuous strife and conflict, and where government, when it came, was usually coming in the force of, you know, a form of a bunch of horsemen with lances coming to mow down your family. You know, nothing good comes of government, and you had to protect your kith and kin personally yourself. So there was sort of a warrior ethic and a great emphasis on individual freedom, responsibility, and sovereignty, and a notion that, you know, orderly, efficient government is in itself can be tyrannical. So those are two very different forms of freedom, one where the individual rising up is the feared, you know, form of tyranny that you'd have in an aristocracy form, and the other being that government structures themselves will tyrannize the individuals. So imagine, you know, you have those two groups in the same state sometimes, as in Pennsylvania or Ohio, and you can have very conflicted politics and indeed you'll find those are some of the key swing states on our electoral college map when we go to vote for president.
You have a chapter in the book entitled Dixie Takes Over, 1968 to 2008. And I would like to focus just for a moment on the tail end of that in the 2008 part, because you make the note that George W. Bush was really the first Southerner, deep Southerner, to win, albeit perhaps without a majority of the vote, and yet still won the election. But you write, by 2008, the first deep Southern administration in 150 years had done incalculable damage to the country while greatly enriching its real constituency, the oligarchy. How did that occur, and where have we come since then?
The ties to the deep Southern regional tradition is that the deep South, the lowlands and Gulf Coast South, started in the area of Charleston and spread that way all the way down through Houston and the Brazos Valley and down as far as Corpus Christi, Texas. And it was not settled the same way Virginia was, which is Virginia was essentially the leaders of the Chesapeake colonies were, you know, the younger sons of English gentry. They were Enlightenment gentlemen who were trying to create a sort of, you know, 17th century version of Downton Abbey, right, where you had responsible aristocrats who took care of society. That was not the case in Charleston, the Deep South. The original colony was basically grafted from Barbados, the English slave sugar plantation island in the West Indies. And it was recreating, you know, deploying a fully formed chain gang style slave system in the southern tropical lowlands. The idea had been sort of a libertarian philosophy that was, you know, the struggle for competition was fought and our families won, and to the winners go the spoils. And from the very beginning, it was always a hierarchical society oriented around the interests of the planter or oligarchic class at the top. The only of the 11 regional cultures identified, the only one that's sort of from the beginning was not oriented around liberal democracy. And the governing ethos was that they expressed was that of classical republicanism, of the republics of the ancient world, of ancient Greece and Rome, where a small subset of people had the privilege of exercising democracy, and slavery and subservience was the natural lot of the many. That's how you could square having a race-based, you know, and caste-based slave society with being in the American Republic. So there's been a consistent, through the deep southern part of history, a certain subset of what we call the South, there's been consistently that form of politics where it's society serves the very people at the very top. And that's been consistent through time, and the George W. Bush administration actually played that out in many of their policies, you know, in a way that is consistent with the regional traditions in Houston, where his political career was built and where many of the people in his administration were from the deep southern regions. So it ties in and reflects a lot of the, you know, regional cultural tropes identified in American nations.
So if we were to sit down 6 months ago and do nothing but watch what has been happening in our country on a political stage, I think most people would be hard-pressed to see an immediate or even a aggressively gradual way of reconciling individual liberty with the maintenance of a free society. Is that fair to say?
That people 6 months ago would have a hard time deciding where the balance point should lie?
Meaning over the past 6 months, there has been such turmoil in a political sense that it seems very hard that we could agree on anything, much less reconciling liberty with the maintenance of a free society.
Yeah, it's how you want to balance those forces. I mean, there has absolutely been a great deal of political turmoil in this election cycle. In some ways, we're seeing a shakeup of both parties, in particular on the Republican side, that may lead to a new consensus on some of these issues in one direction or the other. But there's always been a divide on a regional basis between where the consensus on a lot of those issues lie. You know, you see a consistent pattern on a geographical basis in the emphasis between individual liberty and a laissez-faire form of economics and a more communitarian kind of balance. The surprising thing is in American history previously, you never reached social democracy because all of our regions are on balance more individualistic than our peer liberal democracies in Western Europe. You know, a lot of the West European liberal democracies created social democratic states where you have a vigorous free enterprise system that through taxes is supporting a extensive set of social programs and social services and societal infrastructure. And that's a decision that worked for them but has been rejected in our context because we value that individual competitiveness and dynamism on almost all levels. But for the first time, anytime somebody's tried to head into the social democratic realm too far, it's lost political support, be it FDR and some of his programs and experiments during the Great Depression to some of the efforts under the Great Society and under Lyndon B. Johnson to try to have the government come in and act as the actor to fix neighborhoods, rebuild them, bulldoze a neighborhood and build these towers, or we will promise to fix poverty and enlighten people. And it was a reach of government that was pushed back and also strained the ability of the federal government to actually deliver on its promises. So it's surprising to have a social democrat in this cycle who has been competitive to win a major party nomination, and also rather telling that much of his support is from a new and younger generation who doesn't remember the Cold War and doesn't remember the associations that many people who lived through the Cold War have, where social democracy will be a slide that will lead you down into socialism, where the government takes the means of production, runs the factories and the banks and such. They don't have those associations. Rather, they have the associations that the Republican rhetoric has been that Obama's policies are socialist, and Obama being more of a, in that space of a Teddy Roosevelt progressive Republican of 100 years ago, that may have made socialism normalized, if you know what I mean, by accident in the rhetoric for a new generation who didn't have preconceptions built from the Cold War period. So, yes, we're seeing, especially in that form, maybe generationally, we're starting to see some shifts, which is why, I wonder if we're in a transition period where some of these deadlocks and stalemates about these issues may actually be heading towards some sort of new configuration where there is more consensus. But again, we'll have to wait and see, because if anything, 2016 has been delivering unexpected surprises so far, and it may continue that way.
And maybe that, at the end of the day, is the American character.
The dynamism of it and the flow?
Yes.
Yeah, well, yes. The fact that we have this balkanized geography where we're several Americas has also been a strength, and that it brings forth, many different ideas. In a country that has consensus, you would much more rarely be delivered a strange curveball that your part of the country wasn't expecting. I think it's been a strength in some respects. It's just recently, and at other times in our history, it's led to deadlock and paralysis and dangerous levels of polarization. I mean, we did at one point fight a civil war, was the most cataclysmic thing, but it's also difficult and dangerous for the world to have the world's, most significant, superpower end up in a situation where its federal government is so deadlocked that, Congress can't even agree in a reasonable time frame to, sign the checks for debts they've already voted to incur with things like the debt ceiling. I mean, that's a level of dysfunction that is in itself dangerous and, it's not something that can go on year after year. We are at a point, a challenge for our country that needs to be overcome. The status quo won't do, for that much longer.
The name of the book is American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. Colin Woodard is the author. The book is published by Viking. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. The book is published by Viking. Colin Woodard is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.